Vind je dit een leuke podcast? Luister dan ook naar Veldheren Historisch. Die maak ik, Mart Kruijf, samen met mijn zoon en geschiedenisleraar Tom de Kruijf. Je hoort het al, wij doen dingen die je bij andere podcasten niet hoort. Oftewel, to boldly go where no one has been before. Zo behandelen we ook de slag om Alesia, waar Julius Caesar van twee kanten door de Galliërs werd aangevallen. Hij zou zo'n 1 miljoen Galliërs hebben uitgemoord. En Asterix en Obelix klopt niet.
Zeker, en zo bespreken we ook markante veldheren en legendarische veldslagen uit geschiedenis. Zo kom je bijvoorbeeld te leren waarom het jaar 1870 misschien wel het belangrijkste jaartal is in de geschiedenis. Luister dus Veldheren Historisch via Podimo. En als je je aanmeldt via podimo.nl/veldherenhistorisch, dan luister je 30 dagen gratis.
Liegen over een mondkapjesdeal die je hebt gesloten met de overheid. Een deal waarmee je miljoenen hebt verdiend. Dat doet toch alleen Siewert van Linde? Nou, nee. Ik ben Felicia Alberding en in de Mondkapjesmiljonairs duik ik met een team van correspondenten in andere schandalen. Want wist je dat Siewert helemaal niet uniek is? Luister de Mondkapjesmiljonairs in je Podimo-app. Of ga naar podimo.nl/mondkapjes. En probeer Podimo 30 dagen. Podimo.nl/mondkapjes.
Hoi luisteraar, wij zijn Hugo, Max en Leon van de Grote Podcastlas. Wij zijn drie geografen en elke week behandelen wij een ander land.
We spreken onder andere de geschiedenis, politiek, natuur, maar ook de sport, de muziek en natuurlijk het eten.
De nijlpaarden van Pablo Escobar, de vele bunkers van Albanië en het verschil tussen een sheik en een emir zijn zomaar wat voorbeelden die langskomen.
Maar we bespreken ook de geopolitieke invloed van China in Afrika en de impact van het Europese kolonialisme.
Luister dus wekelijks naar de audioversie van de Atlas, de grote podcastlas.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen met Jaap Janssen.
Hallo, welkom in Betrouwbare Bronnen, aflevering 159 en welkom ook PG.
Dag Jaap.
En voor de vierde keer welkom in Betrouwbare Bronnen, Pirmin Oldeweghuis.
Hartstikke leuk om er weer te zijn, Jaap.
Op 20 januari vindt de inauguratie plaats van de 46e president van de Verenigde Staten, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. Aan het begin van deze aflevering hoorden we de legendarische uitspraak van John F. Kennedy uit zijn inauguratietoespraak in 1961... Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. En er is er nog een die we ons herinneren, van Ronald Reagan in 1981.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
In aflevering 146 spraken we al over de machtsoverdracht in de Verenigde Staten, van de oude president naar de nieuwe. En jullie vertelden toen, PG en Pirmin, dat George W. Bush de overdracht naar Barack Obama op een zeer voorbeeldige manier had gedaan. En we blikten vooruit op de overdracht van Donald Trump naar Joe Biden. En inmiddels weten we dat dit verre van voorbeeldig is gegaan.
Nou ja, om een voorbeeld te noemen, Jaap, dat de mensen die voor de aankomend president Biden, dus alle grote vraagstukken van internationale spanningen, defensie, op het wereldtoneel moeten voorbereiden, dat hij dus gewoon openlijk vertelde, ons wordt alle informatie gewoon geblokkeerd. En de goede contacten die we op zichzelf hebben met mensen in het Pentagon, bij de CIA, bij het State Department, dat die gewoon geblokkeerd zijn, omdat dat niet mag van
ja,
het
zelfs,
Witte Huis.
Zelfs de nationale veiligheidsinformatie die elke dag rechtstreeks aan de president-elect wordt overgebracht, die was er nu niet.
Ik zal je het nog gekker vertellen, Jaap. Oud-presidenten van de Verenigde Staten, dus ook een bijna 100-jarige als Jimmy Carter, krijgt dagelijks zo'n update van belangrijke ontwikkelingen in andere landen, als zo'n president daar behoefte aan heeft, als hij dat wil. De meeste van die oud-presidenten doen dat, omdat ze nog altijd vaak met elkaar veel contact hebben over ook over dit soort vraagstukken. Dus de oud-president krijgt zoiets wel en de aankomend president wordt het onthouden. Dat is ongehoord.
En dan nog los natuurlijk van de overdracht op de dossiers, natuurlijk de bestorming van het Capitool is. Ik heb er een tijdje mogen rondlopen. Het is gewoon bizar om te zien als je die mensen door die gangen ziet lopen waar je normaal gesproken als medewerker van zo'n congreslid.
Ja, dat zijn dus de gangen waar jij dagelijks liep.
Ja, dat zijn gewoon de gangen die de kantoorgebouwen van de Senaat en van het Huis van Afgevaardigden met eigenlijk het Capitool zelf, waar de vergaderzalen zijn.
En je kent bij wijze van spreken, als je naar die bestorming kijkt, je kent elke deur en je weet ook precies wat er achter die deuren zich afspeelt normaal gesproken.
Ja, waar op een gegeven moment de foto's in het kantoor van Nancy Pelosi, dat is een plekje waar je eigenlijk als toerist ook al bijna langs kunt lopen normaal gesproken. Maar als staflid heb je dan extra privilege, dan mag je naar het balkonnetje van Nancy Pelosi toe. Dus die gang waar men toen in die bestorming rondliep, dat is allemaal, normaal gesproken, daar loopt gewoon de staf van Pelosi rond. En het is gewoon zo onwerkelijk om te zien dat het op zo'n vuige manier eigenlijk wordt aangevallen op dat moment. Ja, dat deed mij wel wat.
En het gaat ook vrij huiselijk, hè? Want je kunt in principe overal rondlopen. Er wordt natuurlijk wel gecontroleerd. Waarschijnlijk ook de kleur van je pasje geeft aan waar je mag zijn.
Ja, dat was wel een grappige anekdote. Ik werd mij op het hart gedrukt op de eerste dag toen ik daar kwam. Is van, je moet voor de staff badge gaan. Want als je de intern badge krijgt, dan heb je minder privileges. Dus dat is gelukt. En daardoor mocht je dus op meerdere plekken in het Capitool mocht je ook overal, elk tijdstip, rondlopen.
En was dat een kleurverschil?
De oranje badges waren dat jaar voor de interns en de zwarte badges waren voor de stafleden.
Dus jij moest als Hollander niet voor oranje gaan?
Exact.
Dinsdag is de inauguratie. Wat kunnen we dan verwachten, PG?
Nou, het wordt dus heel bijzonder historisch gezien. Joe Biden schijnt gezegd te hebben, als het echt kan, wil ik toch op de plek waar het altijd is, hè? Sinds Reagan overigens, pas, zou je zeggen, namelijk aan de westkant van het Capitool, zodat je uitkijkt op het Lincoln Monument.
Ik heb het Joe Biden zien zeggen vlak nadat hij de eerste of de tweede injectie kreeg. Ik denk de tweede. I'm not afraid of taking the oath outside.
Precies. Dus anders dan zowel FDR als Ronald Reagan in 85, toen zo ongelooflijk slecht weer was en koud, zegt Biden, als het even kan, wil ik het op die plek waar het echt gebeurt, hè? Dus de grote momenten, de grote traditie, dat is één. Daar zal bijna niemand bij zijn. Dus ook zeg maar een hele kleine groep officiële vertegenwoordigers. En dan komt er een...
Ik begrijp dat de leden van het congres, die mogen er zijn, die mogen allemaal één gast meenemen. Ze zullen allemaal ook op COVID-19 afstand van elkaar worden neergezet. En normaal gesproken zijn er iets van 200.000 kaartjes om daar in Washington op de Mall aanwezig te kunnen zijn.
Dat zijn dus de soort of officiële plekken. En daarachter en daaromheen kunnen dus mensen ook nog, hè, zoals je bij Obama toen zag, met honderdduizenden, ruim een miljoen mensen die er gewoon zelf heen gaan.
Ja, en er wordt nu een soort kunstwerk neergezet met 200.000 min het aantal mensen dat wel aanwezig is. Bij elkaar staan daar dan 191.000 500 Amerikaanse vlaggen en ook 56 pilaren van licht. En dat geeft dus aan, we hadden het eigenlijk anders willen doen dit, maar ja, helaas, dat virus is er, het kon niet anders.
En wat dus Biden nu doet, en dat is iets heel nieuws, en ik durf het vermoeden te uiten dat dat na deze keer ineens wordt geroepen, dat is traditie, dat gaan ze altijd doen. Die wil dus na zijn inauguratie, dat hij de eed heeft afgelegd en zijn speech heeft gehouden, is er dan niet een enorme optocht met alles erop en eraan. Dat gaan ze virtueel doen. Maar hij gaat dan met alle oud-presidenten, dat zijn de presidenten Clinton, Bush junior en Obama en hun echtgenoten.
Ja, Jimmy Carter is er niet bij, want die is en zijn vrouw zijn te oud en die kunnen nu natuurlijk niet reizen.
Die kunnen nu niet reizen en zijn beide in de 90. Dus die zullen op een andere manier ongetwijfeld erbij betrokken worden, maar die zijn er niet fysiek bij. Maar dus de Clintons, de Bushes en de Obama's wel. En die gaan met het echtpaar Biden naar Arlington, dus naar de nationale begraafplaats. En zullen daaraan de president, dus de nieuwe president, zal dan een krans leggen op het, zeg maar, het graf van de onbekende soldaat. Samen met dus die andere presidenten. En dat is natuurlijk een uitermate, zeg maar, powerful symbool van nationale verzoening en ook nationale eer. Want je, wat je hier ziet, zijn dus ook dus presidenten van zeer verschillende herkomst, verschillende partijen en ook van verschillende generaties. En hun first ladies en alle drie natuurlijk presidenten die in Amerika in allerlei opzichten toch hoog geacht zijn. Mede doordat president Trump zijn voorgangers vooral, als daar hun populariteit heeft laten doen, toenemen vooral.
Dit was ongeveer zoals het zal gaan op de dag van de inauguratie. Laten we voor nog wat meer diepgang een echte kenner van Washington D.C. erbij halen. We gaan praten met Bob van Heuvelen. Hij leidt een politiek en strategisch adviesbureau. Je zou kunnen zeggen een lobbykantoor in Washington. En wat vooral interessant is, hij was bijna 10 jaar lang stafchef van senator Kent Conrad, een democraat uit North Dakota. Hij werkte dus dagelijks met senatoren en met leden van het Huis van Afgevaardigden, democraten en republikeinen. En zijn baas, die senator, was onder meer voorzitter van de Senaats Budgetcommissie. En jij, Pierman, jij kent hem.
Ja, Jaap, ik heb een aantal jaren voor Bob gewerkt. Nu denk ik zo'n 3 jaar geleden was dat. En we hebben elkaar leren kennen. We liepen elkaar tegen het lijf op een bijeenkomst georganiseerd door de Netherlands America Foundation en Holland on the Hill, waar dan een beetje de Nederlanders die in D.C. zijn bij elkaar komen voor een hapje en een drankje.
De Hill, dat is het Binnenhof, hè? De Amerikanen noemen dat de Hill.
Capitol Hill. En dat is dan, wordt dan de Hill genoemd. Daar zijn we elkaar tegen het lijf gelopen. En ik heb mijn allereerste baan te danken aan Bob. Dus vandaar dat ik... wij kennen elkaar...
Eigenlijk te danken aan die receptie.
Ja. En ik was er eigenlijk niet geweest. Waar het niet dat toen ik in mijn kantoortje zat... waarschijnlijk een brief aan het schrijven aan een constituent van het congreslid. Toen kwam er iemand binnenlopen en die zei van... vanavond is er een feestje, ben je daar ook bij? Want je bent toch ook Nederlander? En toen zei ik, ik weet van niks. En toen zei hij, wacht maar even, ik ga wel hier en daar even wat voor je regelen. En warempel, een paar uur later werd ik opgebeld... tot ik toch nog een persoonlijke uitnodiging had gekregen. Dus,
zonder dat je de oranje badge had als Dutchman.
Ja.
Maar die Bob die werkt dus ook veel met Nederland in zijn activiteiten. En dan is het handig om een Nederlander ook als assistent te hebben.
Ja, Bob is sowieso heel erg trots op zijn Nederlandse roots. En hij had toen het plan opgepakt om wat meer verbinding te zoeken met Nederland. Vanuit zakelijk gebied eigenlijk. Mij toen gevraagd om hier wat verbindingen te maken, ook met lobbykantoren hier in Den Haag, et cetera, om op die manier zijn netwerk uit te breiden. En daar had hij natuurlijk iemand voor nodig die ook Nederlands sprak en een beetje gevoel had bij wat nou Amerikaanse politiek ook inhoudt. En dat heb ik zo'n 3 jaar voor hem gedaan.
Als ik me goed herinner, want ik heb Bob via jou ook weer leren kennen, Pirmin, was hij dus niet alleen maar 10 jaar belangrijk bij senator Conrad. En dus de budgetcommissie, dat is dus heel belangrijk in de Senaat. Maar nou tientallen jaren wel, hè, in Washington.
Ja, ik denk Bob, en hij wordt ook altijd genoemd in roll call, top lobbyist lijstjes en dat soort zaken. Is gewoon iemand die zijn hele leven eigenlijk rondgelopen heeft op Capitol Hill. Voor verschillende senatoren ook als lid van de staf gewerkt. Natuurlijk chief of staff, wat de soort van de hoogste positie is binnen het kantoor. En dat zorgt er gewoon voor. Hij weet gewoon van voren, van achter, van links naar rechts hoe het Capitool eruit ziet en hoe het daar werkt.
Ja, en als je chief of staff van een senator bent, dat is een soort bedrijfje op zichzelf, hè?
Ja, dat is misschien goed om te zeggen inderdaad. Dat is niet te vergelijken met Nederland, waar een parlementslid natuurlijk hele beperkte persoonlijke ondersteuning heeft.
Want ik ben daar wel eens geweest in de Senaat en dan heb je een afspraak met een medewerker van een senator. En dan kom je een ruimte binnen, een soort receptieruimte. En daar zit dan de secretaresse en nog een paar assistenten. En daarachter zijn een aantal deuren en daar zitten weer de medewerkers. En daar weer achter zit dan uiteindelijk ook de senator.
Ja, je moet meestal door meerdere lagen van staf heen voordat je terechtkomt bij degene die je nodig hebt. Dus de stafleden, dat was ik er ook een van die als eerste tegenkomt, dat zijn vaak de laagste in rangorde. Voordat je met het congreslid, zo'n congreslid heeft gewoon, in ieder geval de senaatskant heeft gewoon zeker 15 mensen die voor die persoon in Washington D.C. werken. En dan hebben ze ook vaak nog in een staat waar ze vandaan komen, ook nog weer mensen voor zich werken die daar veel meer met het contact ook moeten onderhouden met de mensen die...
Dus bij elkaar misschien wel een stuk of 20 mensen die voor een senator werken.
Ja, nog wel meer, denk ik, ja.
En zo'n chief of staff is een beetje, zeg maar, de niet alleen maar de organisator, de logistieke man voor de senator, maar ook een beetje een soort co-strateeg met wie die, zeg maar, zijn werk plant en misschien ook wel zijn herverkiezingscampagne en zijn contacten met het Witte Huis en dergelijke.
Ja, het verschilt heel erg per kantoor, omdat senaatsleden, maar ook leden van het Huis van Afgevaardigden mogen natuurlijk zelf hun staf zo inrichten zoals ze dat zelf prettig vinden. Maar dus ik kan dat niet helemaal voor Bob zeggen, maar in mijn ervaring weet ik in het kantoor waar ik werkte, dat er de chief of staff veel meer de manager was van het kantoor. En dus inderdaad ook de herverkiezing en daar zich ook druk mee bezig hield. En dan had je nog iemand die echt inhoudelijk verantwoordelijk was, eindverantwoordelijk voor het beleid. En dat was eigenlijk, dat waren de twee rollen die je dan had.
Nou, dan zie je dus inderdaad verschil. Ik heb door mijn eigen werk ooit een keer in Washington een heel uitgebreid gesprek gehad met de chef-staf van toen nog senator Edward Kennedy. Want dat was de onderwijsman in de Senaat. En deze man zat al 35 jaar op allerlei terreinen van onderwijsbeleid. Dat was typisch dus ook iemand die voor Kennedy, zeg maar, de wetgeving, wat gaan we nu doen de komende jaren, waar willen we extra geld voor? Dus die heel inhoudelijk vooral ook bezig was en van daaruit echt de grote lijnen uitzette en dus ook onderhandelingen deed met andere senatoren en met bijvoorbeeld de minister. Dus dat was echt zo'n linking pin figuur die je niet ziet, hè, zal ik maar zeggen, in de krant en dergelijke, maar die voor het maken van beleid, ja, zeg maar, misschien wel 10, 20, 30 jaar impact heeft wat betreft wat er in zo'n land gebeurt.
Laten we met Bob van Heuvelen gaan praten.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Welcome to our podcast, Bob van Heuvelen. Might I first ask you about your name, van Heuvelen? That sounds a little Dutch.
Yes, my great-grandfather and great-grandmother left the city of Groningen in 1868 and came to the United States, where they were promised to have free land for farming and gold was paving the roads. They found the free land, but they didn't find gold, and so we've been dirt farmers for most of that time since then.
And you're still searching for gold?
Yes, still searching. That's why I'm on this program.
let's get a little serious. You worked on Capitol Hill for many years. How did you experience the last few weeks in Washington?
Yep, let me tell you this. Without any question, the last few weeks have been unnerving. I've been in Washington for nearly 46 years. These have been the most scary, the most horrifying, the most disturbing. And I was in the United States Capitol during 9/11 when the attacks happened, and this has been worse than that. It has been truly a situation of domestic insurrection and exceptionally unnerving.
Did you experience some specific things that day?
My apartment is very close to the United States Capitol. I did not go over to the Capitol on the day of the vote, but I live close enough so that the sirens and the ambulances and the fire engines and all the first responders, I could hear that very, very well. And of course, like many Americans, we were just glued to the television, probably like many in the Netherlands and all across Europe. It was unsettling. And the images were such that they were very, very familiar. In fact, there's one image where someone is seen breaking down a window in the United States Capitol. That was to the window of my old boss's office, his hideaway in the United States Capitol. So I had a very visceral and personal response to that. In addition to just viewing the United States Capitol as sort of the holy of holies, the true cathedral democracy for our country, it was exceptionally unnerving.
Did you ever expect a thing like this working there?
No. In fact, I've been in and out of the Capitol many, many times, and I've always been greeted by a fairly strict and clear guard, always asking me my business, asking me for my ID, always having arms, and never, ever being lenient about letting people in. So the notion that you could just walk in is clearly not normal. And I've never seen, not since 1812, when the British overran Washington, has the United States Capitol been invaded by a crowd. And never has this happened from a domestic group.
Since the election of Joe Biden as the president-elect, this whole transition period is very different from the normal course of events, isn't it?
It's very, very abnormal. We have a tradition, starting with George Washington, who was the first president of the United States, of a peaceful transition of power. And George Washington, to his credit, who was offered the title of king, said he did not want to be the king, and nor should the American democracy be premised on that. And he was the one who set the stage for peaceful transition of power from one president to the next, even when the two presidents, the leaving president and the incoming president, have been at odds and from different parties, even when they've had very serious arguments. We have never had this kind of dislocation, this kind of anger, this kind of violence. We pride ourselves in the American democracy under the Constitution and our practices in the peaceful transition of power. And everything about this this time since November 3rd, when the national general election was, has been anything except normal.
This is, even if you look in history and you look at the year 1860, 1861, Abraham Lincoln, when he became president, even then there was a sort of normal, peaceful transition, although the country was falling apart. And that is something which struck me as a historian, as a sort of frightening comparison.
I think that's a very fair point. And of course, in 1861 is when what precipitated the secession of the states, the southern states, from the country. And so, but even at that point, the United States Capitol was not overrun. You're absolutely right. Those people who were representing the southern states were not welcome back into the United States Capitol, but that's because they were no longer representing a state that claimed to be part of the Union. So, yes, it's unprecedented, just unlike anything we've seen in the country.
You told us that George Washington was asked to be king. Do you think Donald Trump wants to be one?
There's no question. His admiration for those people who are absolute dictators is without measure. He greatly admires Vladimir Putin. He greatly admires President Xi from China. The president of Brazil and the President Erdogan of Turkey are his heroes. And he's thought this notion of unbridled power, which is fundamentally what a CEO oftentimes has in a small corporation like he ran. That's what he has. But unfortunately, he had no experience with the United States government, no office holding beforehand. He had no concept and has never studied the checks and balances. And so the traditional notion in the Constitution, which is a brilliant document, which has checks and balances, the executive branch is checked by the Congress. The Congress is checked by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is nominated by and checked by the president. And all of them are subject to the notion of impeachment and withdrawal. The notion that is so axiomatic to American democracy simply doesn't seem to have been part and parcel of Donald Trump's either understanding or theology.
There's a very interesting analogy you make, which certainly here in Europe, not many people probably have clear, that Donald Trump was a small CEO of a small business. He, of course, made it look, certainly for, let's say, outsiders, foreigners, as he was this huge businessman in New York with his own tower and with his name on hotels, and it all looked very grand. But in reality, as you now stress, it was a small corporation which was not a point of reference for, let's say, steering a very complex public administration.
Well, even a CEO of a large publicly held corporations like Exxon or like AT&T, like Chevron, has a board of directors. And so if you're the CEO, you don't have unbridled authority. You still are answerable to the board. You still have shareholders who are overlooking your shoulder, and you still have accountability. You can be fired for misdeeds, and you can you can overstep your authority, and the authorities are clearly delineated. Here they are as well, but he didn't understand that because I don't think he had any experience. Either he didn't have any experience or he didn't even want to understand. He basically said in the campaign he could shoot someone in the middle of Madison Avenue in New York City and his followers would still follow him. So he believed, and perhaps still does, that whatever he does can go without sanction, which I believe is going to be a conclusion we hope is going to be completely rejected in the next several days.
Did you ever have the experience of meeting him personally, Donald Trump?
I've never met Donald Trump. I have met Joe Biden on a number of occasions, but I don't know Trump. I know Trump from the television like everybody else does. Joe Biden I've met on a number of occasions. I can tell you about him. He's one of the most decent people, without arrogance, without airs. He's smart. He's steady. He's principled. He is truly comes from a working class background. Everything that he has to his name is something that he has earned, and he has dedicated his life, unlike President Trump, to the public interest. He has never really worked in private industry. He's mined his profits from doing good things for people in his constituencies. So it's a little bit different when you have a business and your complete measure of success is your bottom line and your financial profit. So that defines a very big difference between the two.
What do you expect on January 20th, the day of the inauguration?
Well, as I was driving to my office this morning to prepare for this conversation, I usually drive, it's less than a mile, but I usually drive and I get here in 5 minutes. Today, I was stopped by several armed policemen and National Guardsmen who basically stopped me and asked me my business and really prevented me from getting to my office on time. The reality is, I expect, and we've seen reports, that now there are thousands of armed troops in Washington, D.C., more promised, and they are coming in the with the conviction and the commitment, we're told, to prevent further armed violence from protesters or the incendiary revolutionaries. So I expect that it will be a very subdued exterior inauguration. I expect Joe Biden, who wants to be part of the people, that he will do the swearing in. Unless he cannot do it safely, he will do it as we have done for centuries now on the west front of the Capitol. He will be outside. There'll be a very small crowd. They're actually discouraging people from coming. And so there won't be any claims from President Biden that his crowd is the very biggest ever, because it won't be, and because he has actually asked people to stay away. We'll be watching and glued to the television. I think, you know, the new president will be facing enormous challenges, and that is what's scary to me, just as an ordinary person, knowing what kind of challenges you have in moving government to be solution-oriented. So it's going to be a very tough day. But the inauguration day, I predict, will go across in a peaceful way. We are told Donald Trump will not show, which is also a violation of protocol. In only one other instance have we seen an incumbent president not come to the inauguration of his successor. And that was over 100 years ago. So this is, it's unnerving. Again, it's disappointing. And it sends such a wrong message to the population of the country who desperately needs to unify behind the new president.
But doesn't it make things easier on that very day that Donald Trump is not there?
Yes, it very well might be. And it would be awkward because you can only imagine how difficult it would be for Donald Trump to behave in a ceremonious way sitting on the podium when it wasn't all about him. So the notion that he's not going to be there probably in many ways is positive. But in the larger sense, it's so fundamentally important that we come together. I mean, we've had very contentious elections in the past. When George W. Bush was elected in 2000, he didn't get a majority of the popular vote. Al Gore was there, but people, Al Gore got a million more votes. But he announced the win of George W. Bush from the House floor, and things happened. The inauguration happened. Bush and Clinton and Gore and Cheney were all on the platform together, and the notion of a unity going forward, a loyalty to the Constitution and the fundamental rule of law, has been axiomatic with what makes American democracy unique. And so it's very, very disappointing. Perhaps not surprising, but very disappointing.
So the coming together of America will be the main theme of the speech. What kind of speech will it be?
Well, I think Joe Biden, I think this will be perhaps a paraphrase, but I think he's probably going to say something like, come on, man, this is America, you know, and then in classic form, he loves to make his points, number one, and then number two, and then number three. And I think number one, two, and three will be we need to unify and we need to find common ground. He will absolutely have to focus on the coronavirus epidemic. That has to be really the fundamental. He has to have his eye on the ball there. The notion of testing is now vaccination has gotten very, very messed up. So he's going to have to immediately seize the reins to make that happen. And he's going to have to talk specifically about the economy. We are going into a double-debt recession prompted primarily by the coronavirus. So he's going to have a plan in place to go forward with, which is where I think some of the opportunity for Dutch companies might come, because there'll be an enormous investment in infrastructure that he will announce. And I believe that to the extent that he's looking for a bipartisan approach, both Democrats and Republicans working together, this will be an opportunity to bring in perhaps trillions of dollars of new money to the economy. So I think that's where he will go. He will say it much more eloquently than I just did, though.
Bob, may I ask you a question about you've worked for a very long time as chief of staff in the Senate, and during this time you brought together, I think, the chiefs of staff of all senators in a regular meeting where you tried to find, kind of on the background, bipartisan solutions to pressing problems. Is such an initiative still going on with all the polarization that we see, or does an initiative like that have some promise for the future with Biden, of course, needing the support also in the Congress, where the Senate is split with the VP vote being of Kamala Harris being the vote that can decide. But how do you see this kind of bipartisan workout in the Congress?
Well, I think we've seen this in democracies around the world where you have a very, very close split of power, that you either have complete dissolution of civil society or else you have the requirement that people work together. There are a number of different solution processes in place. One is something I'm very proud of, starting the Bipartisan Senate Chiefs Organization, where the Democratic and Republican principal aides to the United States senators get together off the record and talk about problem solving. There's a new caucus in both the House and the Senate called the Problem Solvers Caucus, where people will be coming together to try to find solutions that can meet with approval on both the Republican and Democratic side. And frankly, that's the enterprise that was successful in making the legislation happen right before Christmas, bringing the new coronavirus response in place. I think there will have to be a commitment to sharing of power. The Senate will be split 50-50. The House has got a very narrow margin for the Democrats. Both the Democrats will be organizing in both places, which will give President Biden a leg up as far as introducing the notions of what he wants to do for recovery. It will give people a fair shot at voting on them, but it will not guarantee that everything he puts on the table will automatically happen. This is not a parliamentary democracy, as you all know. It's not like what the majority party would, or the coalition party would suggest in the Dutch parliament. If President Biden proposes something, he still has a challenge, in, even with his own party, but surely when he has very closely divided government. So I see this as being an interesting time, a particularly interesting time given the business that I'm in, which is basically to find public policy solutions for people. So it's a very interesting moment.
Bob, if you look at, let's say, this inauguration, where the president, in his first speech as president, also as head of state, you know, it's not just a sort of a parliamentary leader. He's the head of state. He's the country. I was thinking of FDR in after his election in 1932 and his inaugural speech in 1933, which was very not rich on specifics, but was a sort of a dramatic speech, but it instilled an enormous confidence. Would that be a sort of an example for Biden this time?
I think it could be. I think it could be. FDR had a gift. A gift of speaking that few have, and I think Joe Biden has shown, particularly since the election, a capacity to go high and to see the large landscape and to speak in particularly inspiring words. I think you've struck a tone that I would hope he could find. That said, I think he also has to get a specific program in place, and whether that's going to be done best from the inaugural platform, whether that's really where he's going to go, I don't know. I mean, given the events of this last week, last Wednesday at about this time, the Capitol was being overrun, and the notion of an insurrection in our democracy has been a completely alien notion. So if Joe Biden really has an eye towards healing, he's going to have to address very directly, in probably broad terms, how important it is for us to find common ground and how important it is to look for our fellow human beings. The people who voted for Trump, I think, have largely found themselves alienated and left behind, which ordinarily, in my experience, would have been the Democratic constituency. So I think there's an opportunity. Whether people will listen, I don't know. The people who were storming the Capitol, many of whom are in jail now, but I don't know that they'll be listening. If you cannot listen, and if the very conservative media channels don't cover the inauguration properly, then an opportunity is lost. So my hope and prayer is that we can find an opportunity for evening out our conversation. I don't know if that'll happen, but I hope President-elect Biden will find those words to lead us to higher planes.
Yeah. Do you probably also expect a moment of silence in the speech, a moment of silence for the victims of the horrific event on January the 6th and also for the victims of COVID-19?
That's, I think, a very good idea. I don't know whether you'll do that. I'm inclined to take your suggestion and send it to my friends in the transition team and suggest that. I think he should do that. I know two of the police officers who lost their lives in this process and know their decency and their humanity, so I hope that we could honor them that way. And, of course, the remarkable number, the astonishing number of people who have lost their lives in the COVID pandemic, they need to be recognized, and we need to do something as a society, frankly, as a world, to get our arms around this. And I hope Biden has actually spoken to people, the families. He's been there, and so I think he will reach out in some way. I think the moment of silence is a particularly profound idea.
Yeah. Do you also think the new president will call upon the rest of the world to work together and to restore the rules-based multilateral world order?
I think there's no question about that. One thing we know about Joe Biden, he spent 36 years in the United States Senate, and a number of those years he was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As such, he has traveled broadly around the world. He is an internationalist. He's a person who really sees the value in working together. He He is a European fan. He has exceptionally good relationships, frankly, with everybody. When he was vice president, he and President Xi of China were both vice presidents, and they got along. He knows how to work the system, and he knows that this go-it-alone idea that Donald Trump had is not going to work. He's announced clearly that on day one, we will be rejoining the World Health Organization, which is critical to the pandemic response. He's announced that on day one, we will be rejoining the Paris Climate Accord. And he has announced that beginning immediately, he will be recommitting to NATO and to the European commitments and to all of our international agreements. And then I think most fundamentally for economics purposes, he's talked about a trade approach which will include the Europeans in trying to find common ground. There's no question in our country that the Chinese have taken advantage of fair trade opportunities and unfair advantage. And I think the same has happened in Europe. Our approach to doing this alone has not been successful. And I think we need to do it in an international way. And the last point on trade I would make is I think very seriously there have been sanctions, Section 232 trade sanctions on European steel and aluminum. I think he will be approaching that in a way that has a holistic approach and will very much want to be working with people. I said last, but really last, I think he will be working with the Europeans on issues related to Russia, because Russia has had a free run over the last 4 years in a variety of ways, including national security and economics, as well as a whole variety of other questions. I think that the notion that we are back, you know, we are back at the table. We want to be leading again, but we surely want to be leading with people is going to be where Joe Biden is. So I think it'll be a change, a dramatic change. And my prayer is that the Europeans and other allies of ours who have gotten their fingers caught in the door with Trump can forgive that and can look past that and find opportunities and common ground for us to work with them, because America is strong, but America can't do it alone.
Bob, it's very interesting, this, especially this last point, because the last few months, the last half year, Germany presided the European Union. And immediately after the election, Chancellor Merkel let her trade minister, who is by chance also her right-hand man already for 20 years, suggest a sort of long-term strategic approach from Europe towards the US on exactly the points, trade, Russia, etc., you name. So the idea from Merkel and from the European leaders was, let's not then wait for Joe Biden to come to us, but let us as Europe also show we're a sort of an equal, and we also want to set the agenda together. But we must be initiators and not just, you know, waiting for the president to sort of, you know, lean towards us. Is that a good approach?
I think that's, first of all, that's a very smart approach for the Europeans to take. If I were back in the motherland, that's what I would be advocating. I think, frankly, it's a strong approach, and it should be welcomed by the United States, too, because our national security and economic circumstance is largely a function of our interrelationships. And having a very strong Europe was, frankly, the whole notion of the Marshall Plan after World War II. The United States had been successful with its allies in vanquishing the Nazis, but it didn't mean we wanted to have a weak Europe. We wanted a strong Europe. And frankly, that's proven to be the great wisdom of the last 50 years, so or 70 years. The notion is, you know, I think we need to have that. I know it's going to be interesting because of Brexit. And so by virtue of what's happened there, there is some division already in the European continent. So by virtue of Brexit, we will have to be negotiating separate trade arrangements with the British, as well as separate ones with the EU. But I think it's really important to have a common understanding. And frankly, the negotiation, the way the European governance system works, it's important to have a position and to understand where you are, because then we can work with you.
how will Biden handle Kim Jong-un? Because North Korea something we from Europe for the last 4 years, we were astonished, and that's the good word for it.
Well, he won't be meeting with them. I don't think he'll be meeting with them. Yeah, I don't think so. If he meets with them, it'll be after all the nuclear missiles have been taken out, and that will be the condition, and it will have to be verified. You know, this notion that you just get to meet with somebody just for a press, for a picture, that was Trump's idea. He won it because that's the media guy he is. Biden is not going to do that. He doesn't need that, and he won't do it. He's enough of a negotiator, you know. Trump is supposed to be the guy of the art of the deal, but for Trump, I guess the deal was, how do I get publicity for myself? The art of the deal, as President of the United States, should be, what's the best deal for the American public? And I don't think, I don't see him going to North Korea unless it's to take down the wall and merge those two countries. That would be a pretty interesting accomplishment, but I don't know. Mr. Gorbachev, take down this wall. I don't know that that's going to happen in Korea in this next 4 years.
Here in Europe, people, you know, the serious people in policy, they were, this whole thing of North Korea, they simply could not believe their eyes and ears. You know, if you think of how Europe, with the Soviet Union, how you had to handle, you know, a dictatorship like that with its, you know, with its human rights and everything, that you think that you can do this is incredible.
Well, it's that. It's sitting down when you have no American interpreter with the president of Russia in a room of three people and having not your own interpreter and having them, you know full well, because he's a former KGB person, recording the whole thing. Can you imagine Joe Biden doing something like that? It's not going to happen. We're going to have a disciplined, organized, serious, and professional response to our international neighbors and competitors. It's not going to be, let's not throw out the all protocol, because from that comes all sorts of mischief. It'll be really, really interesting to see what comes out of having all the instruments, organs of government turned over to a new entity, a new party, a new president, to see what happened, what we know about what happened there. Because I think it's going to be really ugly. We haven't seen, the ugliness is not going to end with this inauguration.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen, een podcast met betrouwbare bronnen.
Can you tell us, Bob, can you tell us something about the appointments the president-elect made for his new government?
Well, that's a great question, Pierman. There's so many firsts that it's pretty exciting. And under the heading of a very, very diverse government, you just have many firsts. And let's start at the very top. I mean, we will, as of January 20th, have our very first woman as Vice President of the United States, our very first person of color as Vice President of the United States. Kamala Harris is smart. She's engaging. She's a very good politician, and she'll be somebody who's fun to watch. Janet Yellen, who helped the United States get through the financial crisis, will be the first female Secretary of the Treasury. Javier Becerra will be the first person of Latino extraction who will be serving as Secretary of HHS. The new Secretary of Defense is the first Black person to serve in that position. The first Pete Buttigieg will be the first openly gay member of the cabinet.
We already know him.
First Secretary of Homeland Security, who is actually an immigrant, who was born in Cuba, will be serving. The first EPA administrator who is Black will be there. The first person who will be, I believe, at the United Nations, or maybe the second woman who is African-American will be representing, maybe the first representing the United States at the United Nations. So it's a very diverse of cabinet. And Biden pledged in the campaign, which has been traditional, I want to have a cabinet that looks like America. This one looks like America. And what's really interesting, it's really an experienced group. I mean, there's been some some criticism that it looks like a rerun from the Obama administration, and some of these people are veterans. That's not a criticism that I think is wrong. It's also an advantage. These people are going to walk in on day one, and they're going to know not just where the men's room and the ladies' rooms are, but they're going to know how the organizations work, and they're going to know people in the other governments, and they're going to know how the government comes together to make things happen. And that's, I think if we've learned one thing out of Donald Trump, is that having a president who's inexperienced, who doesn't understand government, who didn't know how things worked, didn't work. That was a mistake. The voters thought this would be fun. They didn't respect the notion of government as being a process of great moment. And this is a crew that has a great commitment to making it work, starting with the president-elect, because he knows this government.
So what you see here is a government which, as they say, can hit the ground running.
Yes.
And what is also interesting, which I heard also, for instance, from that German minister, confidant of Merkel, that he said that as Minister of Trade, it was really tough. If you have no one in America you can call when there is a problem or a conflict or something threatens to become a conflict, you know, you're sort of stuck. So he was sort of happy with Mr. Wilbur Ross, who was in Trump's government, because he was 82 or something, but at least he was an experienced man from, let's say, as a CEO or something. So he said, at least this was somebody we could talk to. Now, the fact that there's such an important minister in Europe says that he was sort of happy to have somebody he could talk to is not a good way to get your business done, to run your government. And let's say Mr. Blinken or Mrs. Yellen, you know, she can pick the phone and, you know, everybody in the financial world and et cetera knows who she is.
Well, I think you make a really good point. And then the other point that I would make is that, you know, Trump put together a cabinet of people he didn't know because he didn't have any experience in government. And so the Secretary of State, he didn't know the Secretary of State. And so the Secretary of Defense, he didn't know the Secretary of Defense. And right down the line, the Secretary of the Treasury, he didn't know. So he had to get to know these people, their strengths, their weaknesses. And you saw a remarkable turnover in the Trump administration, you know, rapid turnover, lots and lots of change, and never ever really got their
firing by tweet.
That's different.
You know, people were fired by tweet.
Really, frankly, that's ridiculous. I mean, the whole notion, it's not ridiculous to communicate with the people, but it's ridiculous to rule and announce government decisions in that fashion, because the people in the government, they were taken by surprise. And Joe Biden has the commitment and the understanding of process where I don't think he will be doing that.
Bob, you mentioned Kamala Harris as a unique election as vice president, but she also has a very particular role in the Senate, and broader than that, what do you think will her role be in this administration?
Good question. Again, what Joe Biden has said is that he expects Kamala Harris to be his partner and to take the same kind of a role in the administration that Joe Biden had in the President Obama's administration, which was to be there for the big conversations, be there for the big decisions, and be the last person to talk to the president before a decision is made. That's a pretty powerful position. It was a powerful position with Donald Trump, because the last person to talk to him always was the one who got the air. In this case, I think she's serious-minded. She's very, very smart. She's a terrific lawyer. I think you see already some of the impact of her participation in the critical personnel decisions. She personally has been very committed to diversity, and I think the notion that some of the people who are in the new cabinet are people that she knew. So I see her as being a particularly interesting contributor to the whole administration. We'll see what kind of responsibility she gets. I mean, fast forward, or going backwards, when Joe Biden was first inaugurated vice president, we were in the middle of the financial crisis, and President Obama gave Joe Biden the responsibility to do the economic recovery, which was frankly the only reason we came out of that. And he's the one who negotiated the agreement with the Congress. I don't know if that's what Vice President Harris will be doing. I suspect that would be a major component. Also paying attention very closely to the coronavirus response, because that's going to be axiomatic to the recovery of the country across the board.
What will happen the next 4 years to the Republican Party?
Well, you know, we've color-coded our parties in the United States, and for reasons that I don't understand fully, the Democrats have been labeled blue and the Republicans red, and I would just say the red wall is showing some cracks. It's very much a party in that's confused, it's splintering. You might even go so far as to say there's civil war within the party. Their fundamental issue is going to be, do they want Donald Trump to be still their acolyte? Is he going to be the behind the altar that they're worshiping, or is it going to be a post-Trump era? It's a little different than after 1974, when Richard Nixon was thrown out of office. The Republican Party had no trouble sort of taking its licks and going on. There's a fairly strong commitment in the voting base to Trump. I saw a poll yesterday saying 45% of Republicans support the insurrection. So if that's going on, then the Republican Party, even the voters, are tied up, and that means there'll be a real splintering. Some have talked about starting a whole new party. I wouldn't be surprised if you didn't see some of the people like Ted Cruz and this Josh Hawley being censured and put into a little different box, which could be so infuriating to them that they go off into their own party. That's not a good answer to American democracy. Unlike the Netherlands, where we've had a tradition of two parties, and that has worked largely for us, and I hope that we can have a strong Republican Party, even though I'm not one anymore. I hope we have a good, strong one with a responsible commitment to government. But I'm not. That's going to be a work in progress.
But you need, in the kind of democratic model you have in the U.S., you need more than one party who can be sort of a responsible adult. Now, we in Europe, the last few days, we were struck, as you can imagine, we look with some distance, that suddenly the daughter of Dick Cheney is sort of developing as an important sort of responsible, let's say, longer-looking leadership.
Liz Cheney.
So you can imagine, from a European point of view, that was quite a surprise.
Well, it's very surprising, except if you recognize that Donald Trump went after Dick Cheney in a number of different instances, so that the two families have not been getting along for a while. And that's how some Republicans will dismiss Cheney. But the way she wrote her letter announcing her support for the impeachment was without a doubt one of the roughest, toughest, clearest statements as to why Donald Trump is not suited to serve as president. So that is not going to be unimportant to folks. And Dick Cheney's reputation in the Republican Party is surely not one of being a gentle soul. He's not one who rolls over easily. Dick Cheney's reputation as being
very tough,
one who throws punches, wears a steel, throws a steel fist, is very clear and probably earned. And so Liz Cheney doing what she did, it was a pretty interesting statement. She has great ambitions too, as I understand. So this was not an act without courage, nor was it an act that is without significance. It's a very good question.
Does Liz Cheney have the highest ambition to become president one day?
That's what I'm told. We still haven't had a female president, so I was told a couple of years ago when she decided not to run for the United States Senate that she wanted to be in leadership, she wanted to be the first female speaker, and then she wouldn't mind being the first female Republican speaker. And she wouldn't mind being the first female female president. So,
is it already 2024 for the year for a race between Kamala Harris and Liz Cheney?
I don't know. I mean, I think at this point there's such the people who are strongly supportive of Donald Trump are not going to go away in the Republican Party. He engendered enormous and remarkable support there, so I don't know that it would be that. Some have suggested that if Donald Trump himself isn't going to run, and he may be precluded from running by virtue of what happens in impeachment, that his daughter might want to run. So you could have Ivanka Trump versus Liz Cheney, And that could be a very, very interesting run.
Bob, they would write an opera about that, about those two ladies. So a soprano and a mezzo. Oh, this would be a great opera.
I think there you go. There you go. I think so.
And Bob, may I ask one more question about, because of course the Republican base of Donald Trump will not go away, but on the other hand, there is within the Democratic Party, of course, also a, well, perhaps not as large, but a significant progressive wing who is also making demands. And Biden will have, with his message of unity, of course, have to position himself somewhere in between. So how do you see the influence of these progressives within the Democratic Party on the platform and the policies of Joe Biden?
I think it will have some measurable impact, and the fact that the Senate now is going to be barely democratically controlled will allow Biden to give some nods to the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. I think Biden himself is a moderate, and he's never ever claimed to be anything else. He will have to look for opportunities to mollify those folks with some very progressive actions. I think the polling data showing coming out of the November election showed that a lot of the votes that were cast against Democratic candidates were cast against them because they were they had been defined as socialists. And so to the extent that the progressive wing of the party has an agenda that has a socialist bearing, that's going to be a very big problem for Biden to embrace, and it surely will be difficult for to get anything through the Congress. You're right, Pierman, and again, it shows your experience here in Washington that you know how difficult this can be, and there are splits on every side. I'm sure this is true in the Netherlands too with the individual parties, but here it's very clear.
Maybe Bob, the last question. You are a policy and strategic consultant. You talk with people on the Hill, I think almost on a daily basis. People in government also. Will your job become easier from now on?
Yeah, it's a really, I would say maybe when I first started out, I would have said yes, but nothing about this business is easy. Even when you think it's going to be easy, it's not easy. The margins of party control are such that I don't think easy decisions are upon us. And so the negotiations between the parties who don't get along very well anyway are going to be very, very difficult. I think each party is going to be looking for opportunities to show that they've been successful on behalf of their voters. So there are some topics that have overwhelming support, such as the vaccine distribution and such as infrastructure. So I think parts of this will be easier. Mitch McConnell no longer being the Republican majority leader in the Senate is important because he had pledged with the Obama administration to do everything to make President Obama unsuccessful in a one-term president. I think he was about to do the same thing to Joe Biden. So at least with the Democratic leader as the majority leader, we will have issues presented to the Senate to vote on. Doesn't mean things will happen always, because there are, as Pierman pointed out, there are conservative Democrats who won't go along with every liberal idea, and there are progressive Republicans who will want to vote with the Democrats. So it's going to be an interesting opportunity. I think that over time, where I've felt that the government and the politics were fracturing and going far right and far left, I actually think that the result of the November elections and these runoffs is that we will have to come together. And so there might be an opportunity for cementing a center approach to governance and to find a common ground. And that's my prayer. We probably need to look at how the Europeans have done this. When you put together coalition governments, how do you do that? You can't tell me that you have a coalition government and the prime minister and the foreign minister who are headed in different parties like each other. They nothing about the fact the elections passed makes them any happier to be in the same room with each other, but somehow you've made it work. And we've got to figure that out. And that's a new problem for us. So maybe we should go back to our roots. Maybe I'll come back to the homeland and take course from you all as to how Dutch politics works. And the Dutch government was such a model was so important to the American Constitution. the way the church was organized, the way your government was organized, I think they were very much the model for our Constitution. Maybe it's time for us to go back to school.
Bob, I have two more sort of teasing questions for you. The first one is...
those others didn't count?
No, of course not. The first one is, we're now on our own, nobody is listening. If you could give from your decades of experience in D.C. one really good sort of secret tip, sort of advice to Joe Biden, what would it be?
Well, I think the secret tip is one that he knows. And if you look at the very, very successful presidents of the United States, the very successful ones, they figured out that you have to work with every member of the leadership. And you cannot just sit back in your ivory tower and expect it's going to be done. So you look at Franklin Roosevelt, who did that. He played cards with people. You look at Lyndon Johnson, who was constantly on the phone with people. By contrast, Barack Obama was very much hidden in the White House, didn't get out and didn't reach out. So Joe Biden, who likes people, he's an extrovert. I think if he does anything that's different, he will show respect to his Republican colleagues. He will reach out, but he will not just do it on the Republican side. That's what, you know, Ronald Reagan did that to the House Republicans. He just dealt with Democratic Speaker O'Neill and made all the Republicans in the House mad. I think Joe will understand, knows already. He's a 36-year veteran of the United States Senate. He knows how the sausage gets made, and it's by talking to people. It's by hearing them out. It's by listening. It's, you know, the thing about Trump is he doesn't listen. He just talks. And Joe Biden has turned into a listener. I think it's taken him a little bit of time to get there, but he is a good listener. And I think he will reach out. That's the secret I hope he will follow.
The second question I had, what is true about the rumor that Michelle Obama will go to the Supreme Court?
Oh, I don't know. She'd be an exceptionally... I think she should be the next president myself, but I heard yesterday that it could be Barack Obama. Given the way the Republicans make nominations to the Supreme Court, though, they have to get people who are in their 40s, so they last a long time. And even though Barack Obama and Michelle Obama are still relatively young people, surely from my vantage point, they're young people, they may not be young enough. To say that would they make a difference? Phenomenal difference. I mean, that would just be an extraordinary, extraordinary appointment. I would hope that could happen.
Bob, may we thank you very much for this wonderful conversation. I wish you good luck being part of a more united United States. And I hope we can come together after Corona, maybe in Washington, maybe in the Netherlands.
I would love that, and I appreciate the opportunity. I'm so proud of my Dutch heritage, and every time I get to go to the Netherlands, I find out again, even though I'm relatively tall in the United States, I'm a shorty when I go to the Netherlands. So it's always good for me to go back to my roots and figure out why it is I feel so strongly about some things and where I found the principles that I live by. And it all is traced back to my good Dutch Reformed grandfather who preached and who felt very strongly about values. So thank you. Thanks to the Netherlands for leaving me with that heritage, and thanks for this interview. It's Jaap, I'm so pleased. Thank you. Thanks, Pierman. Be well. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Dat was een interessant gesprek.
Ja, dat is ongelooflijk leuk om iemand die zich toch een beetje gewoon een Nederlander voelt. Ja, het is heel, vooral affectief. Hè, trots op een Dutchman zijn. En met natuurlijk zo'n ja, bijna ongekende hoeveelheid know-how, ervaring en ook humor. Maar je hoorde ook zijn emotie. He, dat hij gewoon op een bepaald moment zei, ik bid ervoor dat president Biden dit en dit gaat doen. He, ook zijn bijna fysieke angst over wat er gebeurde de voorbije dagen. He, nou ja, net als Pirmin in het begin zei, die gangen waar je die gekken zag lopen en mensen van alles stuk zag slaan, dat waren de gangen waar ik, als het ware, naar mijn kantoor liep, waar mijn collega's zaten.
En dat is iets wat wij ons misschien in Europa nog niet eens zo bewust zijn geweest bij het zien van die vreemd uitgedoste types die daar dan door dat gebouw lopen.
Ja, wat ik vooral ook interessant vond was dat we toch zeg maar als wereldgemeenschap weer dichter bij elkaar zullen komen onder deze nieuwe president. Want Amerika moet natuurlijk in zichzelf weer geheeld worden, zou je kunnen zeggen. Maar al die internationale relaties die er waren en die de afgelopen 4 jaar verwaarloosd zijn of zelfs helemaal doorgeknipt zijn door de Trump-regering, die moeten ook weer met elkaar verbonden worden.
Ik vond zeer interessant wat hij echt vanuit die binnenkant even liet blijken. Dat natuurlijk elke president en vicepresident een eigen taakverdeling heeft. Hè? Bush en Cheney was anders dan Obama en Biden. En dat je eigenlijk van hem, ik pikte op dat hij zei, Kamala Harris zit ook nog in die Senaat voor. Hè, met 50-50 zal ze daar veel te doen hebben. Ze kijkt naar de benoemingen, diversiteit daarbij. Bijna een soort binnenland figuur. En dat hij zei, ja, Biden met zijn enorme internationale, ook internationalistische achtergrond, ook als vicepresident voor Obama, voorzitter van de commissie buitenland van de Senaat heel lang, die zal zeker zelf, als het ware, dat opnieuw knopen van die contacten gaan doen. Dat vond ik een opvallend punt van wat ik dacht, dat heb ik op die manier nog niet zo eerder gehoord.
En ik denk ook dat er voor ons Europeanen of Nederlanders ook wel een opdracht ligt. Omdat het natuurlijk van ons ook vraagt om iets te vergeten, Trump eigenlijk te vergeten. En ik denk om de machtsdynamiek in de VS ook goed te begrijpen, moeten we ook accepteren dat Trump zometeen gewoon voorbij is. En dat je een nieuwe president Biden hebt die best wel veel invloed heeft op waar het dan naartoe gaat. En ik weet niet of we daar historisch gezien zo goed in zijn om dat soort dingen makkelijk te vergeven. Maar we moeten dat denk ik wel doen om zelf ook zo effectief mogelijk onze punten te kunnen behalen als het aankomt op klimaat en op handel met de Amerikanen. Als we te veel blijven hangen, dan gaat dat ook niet lukken.
Ja, en aan de andere kant moeten we denk ik ook voorkomen als Europa dat we terugvallen in het oude idee wat we natuurlijk heel lang gehad hebben van die Amerikanen leiden ons in de wereld en wij wachten af en we reageren. Nee, Europa moet, dat hebben we wel geleerd de afgelopen jaren, ook zelf het initiatief nemen. En ook op dit niveau zou je eigenlijk bipartisanship, maar dan tussen de Verenigde Staten en de Europese Unie moeten hebben.
Het was heel opvallend toen ik even refereerde aan hoe Merkel had gewacht tot die verkiezingen. En toen Peter Altmaier, we hadden het erover toen we het Duits voorzitterschap van de EU bespraken, Jaap, dat die ineens dat initiatief nam, nu gaan we dit en dit. Dat hij dus als Amerikaan zegt, nou had ik aan de andere kant van de oceaan gezeten, was dat mijn advies geweest. Europa moet ook laten zien dat het niet achteraf leunt. En denkt van, nou, we horen wel waar die Biden mee komt. Nee, laat ook zien dat je dus zelf die connectie weer legt. En heb ook een eigen inzet daarbij. Neem ook als Europa een beetje, wat jij zegt, bipartisanship, ook je eigen verantwoordelijkheid in het herstel van die relatie.
Dat hebben we natuurlijk ook besproken al in de aflevering over het voorzitterschap van Portugal. Ook Portugal is dat zeker van plan.
Dat was heel opvallend dat ze dat onmiddellijk opgepakt hadden. En daarom vond ik het interessant om dit nu bij zo'n ervaren iemand even als het ware af te tasten. Wordt dat niet als van wie denken de Europeanen wel dat ze zijn opgevat? Nee. Meer in de zin van, we gaan dus nu echt ook bijna, in zekere zin als gelijken, maar ook serieus dan ook het invullen.
We kunnen dus weer wat optimistischer naar de toekomst kijken. Pirmin, jij in het bijzonder, dank je wel voor het leggen van het contact met jouw oude baas, Bob van Heuvelen.
Ja, graag gedaan Jaap en hartstikke leuk om hier weer te mogen zijn.
Zo, dit was Betrouwbare Bronnen, aflevering 159. En ik mag weer een aantal nieuwe vrienden van de show welkom heten. Mensen die ons blij hebben gemaakt met een donatie, klein of groot. Evert, Sjoerd, Peter, Maria, Frank, David, Jeroen en Alderik. Allemaal dank en welkom bij de vrienden van de show. En wat Betrouwbare Bronnen betreft, tot volgende keer.
Betrouwbare Bronnen wordt gemaakt door Jaap Jansen in samenwerking met dag-en-nacht.nl.